sectors does it have? What frequency region does it cover? If you happen to know any of those parameters, John, KC2SHO, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Yeah, Dick, it's been a few, probably more than a few months since I've even glanced at these. But I might recall something like, UHF into, well, it's all UHF into 3 gig, right? But so, yeah, definitely UHF band. How much of it, I forget. The power level, I want to say something like 300 watts just on this particular, board. And it's just a single output. It wasn't very advanced. But I think there might have been some software control built on as well, maybe for monitoring or something like that. I don't know. It's been a long time. I didn't look into it that deep in the beginning. It's just interesting to an RF guy to see what they're doing. And yes, there are RF ovens available on the market. I don't believe you and I will be buying them anytime soon. I want to say the unit I saw maybe a year ago or so was something in the range of $3,000. Someone who maybe really is putting a lot of money into their kitchen might want to brag about that and be a early adopter, but I think we're quite a few years away from seeing these being, installed in a average kitchen. Go ahead.
In the very early days of microwave ovens, well, let me think now, this is probably 1960, is that possible? Let's see, 1950 something or other, when the Raygun company had something called the radar range. Radar range, I think they called it. And I think it was something almost as big as a refrigerator, and it did start off at numbers like $3,000. So we're repeating history. If I was running some kind of an industrial testing facility, and if I want all of the flexibility that this RF solid-state oven can provide, maybe I'm willing to pay $3,000. Will the consumer today pay that when he can buy a microwave oven for sometimes under $100? I doubt it very highly. So a consumer is not going to do that. Even to brag about it, he's not going to do it. And by the way, the instant heating strikes me a little bit strange because the filament of a magnetron, the way they're set up, they heat up in roughly 1 second. So if I'm going to run the microwave oven for 60 seconds and it takes one extra second for it to warm up for its filament, that's nowhere near enough motivation to go over the solid state. So there's a lot of crazy questions here. I'm having trouble believing that a solid state RF oven in the next 5 years is going to become cheap enough to become a consumer product as opposed to the Magnetron version of it. That's my belief. We'll soon find out if it gets in my pod. Wes, I think, wanted to ask a question. N2XJN, K2RIW. Go ahead, Wes.
Yeah, you said that frequency is rate of change of phase. But for me, it is as simple as statement saying that the rate of change is of velocity is acceleration. So let me go back to that. So you said that phase, rate of change of phase is a frequency. So I have a question for you. What is rate of change of phase? Is it frequency? Is it oscillation, or is it rotation into XGN?
Okay, I'm going to give you an example that maybe will help a little bit, Wes. Assume I've got a circuit that's generating a signal at 1 gigahertz, 1,000 megahertz, 1 gigahertz is the frequency being generated. That means each individual cycle takes 1 nanosecond, a billion cycles per second. 1 over a billion is a nanosecond, so each complete cycle takes 1 nanosecond. The cycle of that signal coming out, you are tracing it on a polar display of some kind, and it's a of course you're slowing down the polar display so you can see what's happening, but a polar display of the signal coming out of that 1 gigahertz signal generator would go between 0 and 360 degrees. That's what a phone cycle is. You're going from 0 to 360 degrees in 1 nanosecond. So 360 degrees per nanosecond is the rate of change in phase that equals 1 gigahertz of frequency. So that helps you see a little bit the relationship between frequency is rate of change, 360 degrees in 1 nanosecond. If my signal generator is now generating a 2 gigahertz signal instead of a 1 gigahertz signal, that means it's going between 0 and 360 degrees, not in 1 nanosecond, but it's doing it in half a nanosecond. 360 degrees per half a nanosecond, you could say, is 720 degrees per nanosecond. So once again, you can see that a higher frequency in direct linear relationship is a rate of change in phase. So rate of change in phase equals frequency. Well, frequency is the rate of change in phase. There's a one-to-one relationship there between the two. You could call that. So if now I'm chopping up my signal into very tiny little pieces in the amplitude domain, but I have the ability to measure the difference in the phase between the beginning and end of one of my sub-pulses, and I can look at the rate of change in phase, even though I don't have a complete cycle during one pulse, I have a way that I can sort of predict what frequency is within that pulse, what's the main carrier frequency. So, rate of change in phase equals frequency. In some cases, that can help. There's ways you can get in trouble with it, because depending on your display device, many phase display devices have a built-in kind of nonlinearity. And so when you're looking at sub-pulses, pulses that are a fraction of a cycle long, the nonlinearity in your circuitry can lead you astray. This is not an easy one to accept. The first time you hear this jazz, Wes. N2XJN, K2IW, and TechNet.
N2XJN. Yeah, my question was related to semantics that you use. If you say that frequency is rate of change of phase, then reverse of it would be that what is the rate of change of phase? Would that be frequency, oscillation, or rotation? And the right answer would be rotation. So then we don't have a reverse relation indirect. Only when you try to simplify it makes sense. Let me drop. So frequency is inverse of the time period equivalent to one cycle of the waveform. And phase is a different instance of waveform which have different phase values. And one cycle will have the total 360 degrees, which is equal to pi radians, which is actually rotation. That's why frequency offset could be measured in frequency domain and time domain. So, let me drop. So, a turn is the unit of plane angle measurement equal to 2 pi radians, which is 260 degrees, or 400 radians. A turn is also referred as a cycle and revolution. That's why it's not that your answer was wrong. It was too much simplified. Maybe I'm wrong. And to agree.
A little bit of what's going on here is the problem of in-phase and quadrature not being considered. Many of us will display a signal on an oscilloscope and we see a sine wave. That sine wave, you could say, starts at zero, goes up to, say, plus 1 volt, comes back down to zero, goes to minus 1 volt, and back up to zero, with that smooth shape that we call a sine wave. On an oscilloscope, we think we're looking at a signal, and we see a sine wave. Is that what the signal really is? That's not clear, because you're only looking at the in-phase component. If you had a display that's also looking at the quadrature component, the quadrature component would be 90 degrees displayed. During the time that the in-phase signal is going through zero, the quadrature signal is going through either maximum amplitude positive or maximum amplitude negative. So if you're displaying the in-phase signal and the quadrature signal simultaneously on an oscilloscope, you draw a circle. You don't make a sine wave. You draw a circle on a polar display. The circle has constant amplitude as it goes from 0 and 360 degrees. So is a signal only that sine wave that we see, or is it really the sine wave plus the quadrature signal? And in order to fully characterize the signal, to really know its real amplitude versus time and its real phase versus time, you must have a in-phase measuring equipment and a quadrature measuring equipment. So whenever you have a vector demodulator on circuits, like say for instance the RFID kind of
repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
And you're simultaneously looking at the positive and negative polarity and the amplitude of the quadrature signal. And it takes the combination of the instantaneous measurement of amplitude and polarity of the in-phase signal and the amplitude and polarity of the quadrature signal in order to define where are you in that particular cycle of that signal during that instant you made that measurement. So to fully characterize a signal requires a vector demodulator. A vector demodulator is an in-phase and a quadrature detecting circuit, and now you're fully characterizing the signal. So does the signal really go through zero? Could say it does not. On a simple display like an oscilloscope with only one phase of that signal, you'll think it goes through zero periodically. But there really is energy there as it's going through zero. So there's a lot of confusion here about a sine wave going through zero periodically. If you made an instantaneous measurement during the instant the signal is going through zero, you would think nothing is there. But during that instant, your quadrature demodulator would show you a maximum amplitude signal, positive or negative, depending on whether you're at the 0 degree point or the 180 degree point. Your polarity would be different on your quadrature demodulator. So to fully characterize a signal, there's a little bit more going on than what you see on a symbol, on a simple one display oscilloscope. There's more going on than what we usually display. In many cases, that simple display is good enough. In other cases, it's not enough information. I know I haven't answered your question.
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout, cancel.
Dick, thank you very much, Dick, for your answer. And if we have a time in the science section, together with Dr. Roy, I sent him the question. Your thoughts about Carcitron, CARCINORON. Carcinotron, I'm sorry, carcinotron. It's a backward wave oscillator, it's a tube. Enter HGF.
Yeah, I heard the word carcinotron used with super high frequency signal generators. Okay, we're going to go over to Rich now. WB2 GXM. WB2 Golf X-ray Mike. Sorry to keep you waiting, Rich, hope you're still with us. WB2 GXM. K2IW in the TechNet.
K2IW in the TechNet. This is Whiskey Bravo 2 Golf X-ray Mike. Thanks, Dick. I just wanted to make a follow-up comment to my question of last week. I wanted to thank the gentleman who pointed me in the direction of N3FJP logging software. I've been investigating it, and it's not free, but for a modest sum, it's very customizable, completely customizable, and what's most valuable is it gets out of your way very quickly, which I like. Now, all I have to do is enter a call sign and a couple of space bars, and it's gone and it's done. I like it. So, thank you, and WB2GXM.
Okay, Roy, looks like Roy and Colt, looks like we got a happy customer. I'll have to send him a bill. That's a joke. Glad the information did you some good, Rich. Settle up. We don't have all the answers, but we bring enough people together on this TechNet over the years that the combined brain sometimes comes up with some good information. Okay, I'm going to go over to Roy now. It's way beyond the time. We should be over to Roy for the science talk. And 2GS. K2REW. Go ahead, Roy.
Thank you very much, Dick. This is AC2GS. Echolink, unfortunately, hasn't been feeling well this past night. I had to be rebooted and the audio is gone. But I set up an alternative stream at technet.ac2gs.com if anyone needs to have an audio stream. So that seems to be working reasonably well. There are four or five people there. Anyway, as always, if anyone has any topics or questions or comments about what I say, the email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. For links, Paul has a link up for a story he's going to tell you after me. You can find that and links to the stories that I give as time allows, roy.ac2gs.com. And there's always the chat room. That's at chat.ac2gs.com. And once again, if anyone's having problems with the audio, it's technet.ac2gs.com. Okay, on with the show. Helium. Helium's a fascinating element that we've mentioned before. It was first discovered on the surface of our sun long before we found traces of it here on Earth. It's the second most abundant element in our universe, by both number and by mass. When the universe was in its infancy, a very youthful 380,000 years, the intense energy left over from the Big Bang had spread out far enough to allow bare nuclei to retain their charge, balancing electron clouds, and neutral atoms were born. Same event finally caused the universe to be transparent to all those photons created by the Big Bang, and release a flood of electromagnetic energy into our universe that has spread itself out so thin that we now call it the cosmic microwave background. But that's a whole other story for another time. When the universe first developed neutral atoms, 92% of them were hydrogen atoms by sheer numbers, and 8% of them were helium atoms by sheer numbers. If you consider their masses, though, 75% of all the mass in the universe was hydrogen, while the remaining 25% was from helium atoms. Let me drop for a second. Just because helium is the second most plentiful element in our universe doesn't necessarily mean it's plentiful here on Mother Earth. The problem with helium is that it's a fairly inert noble gas. It rarely combines with any other atoms, and it's so light that it drifts up to the outermost areas of our atmosphere and then drifts away from our Earth. We get some helium from the solar winds caused by our sun, but that really isn't terribly helpful. Fortunately, here on Earth, the Earth makes its own helium. Some of the radioactive elements in the Earth's core decay via what's called alpha decay. The alpha particles are just helium nuclei. Mines and pockets of natural gas are an excellent source for helium, slowly forming from the decay of larger, more unstable elements deep within the Earth. Helium is an essential chemical element used in MRI scanners, rocket fuel tanks, and floating party balloons. It's also a finite natural resource, and a global shortage has made it harder to sell balloons at Party City, which is now closing 45 stores. Let me drop for a sec. On this past Thursday, the Party Supply retail chain announced plans to shut down about 5% of its stores across the country this year. Okay. attributing some of its final first quarter financial losses to helium challenges. In a statement, the CEO, James Harrison, said that the company usually closes 10 to 15 stores a year, and for a company whose success is strongly tied to the emblem of a traditional party, the humble balloon, being unable to provide one that can float presents a serious problem. In a post on its website, Party City offers some of the creative hacks for decorating with helium-free balloons. They said you can create a balloon arch or a balloon wall with latex and foil balloons as seen below. The company wrote, no need for helium, just some taste and creativity. But for those who don't get the same jubilant satisfaction taping a balloon to the wall as they do seeing one hover and eventually collect dust in the corner, the current helium shortage and the subsequent closure of a bunch of Party City locations is probably a bummer. And it's also pretty devastating for a number of non-party-related fields that depend on the inert gas, like the scientific and medical community. Let me drop for a sec. Industry and scientists are going to be really creative. Phil Kornbluth, a helium industry consultant, told National Geographic last year, if we get to the point where we can't keep up with demand, either prices will go up to create new incentives to find more, or we're going to develop substitute technologies that don't rely on helium. Thankfully, for balloon fans at least, Party City says that it signed an agreement with a new helium supplier to provide more of the squeaky stuff this summer. So, our helium balloons are safe for the time being, but this offers me no opportunity for a, but this offers me an opportunity for a puzzler for tonight. As mentioned earlier by Matt, at the dawn of the universe, 75% of all normal matter was in the form of hydrogen, and 25% was in the form of helium. It's been 13.8 billion years now since then, and that's a lot of stars burning fuel and fusing light elements, the heavier ones, not to mention all those supernovas, collisions, and, two neutron stars colliding and producing tons of heavy elements like gold in their wake. So, our question for tonight is, what is the present percentage of normal matter that makes up our universe that is hydrogen, and how much is helium? Any takers?
Next up.
Yes, Rich.
Hazard guess at 40% helium, 60% hydrogen.
Down for 40-50. Anyone else with any suggestions? Come on, Rich can't be the only one who wants to play. Like I said before, by mass, 75% of all the mass in the universe of normal matter at the very dawn of time was hydrogen, and 25% of it was helium. So it's been 13.8 billion years. How much of the other stuff do you think the universe has created for us? I mean, think of all the things you're made of, and a lot of them aren't helium or hydrogen.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I would say maybe it's only a 1% difference. You know, I think it's pretty much what it was. You know, because I think there's still so much out there that has never coalesced. So, what was the original number? 75. So I'm just gonna go with 74. Rourke.
Very good, Paul. Anyone with any other comments, suggestions, guesses, what have you?
In one whitey white.
Yes, Hank.
I think Paul's on the right track, but I'm going to guess it's just something.
Hank, both of you have close to the answer I'm looking for. So if anyone else has any suggestions, please feel free.
I'm going to guess, again, just like I guess Paul did, 1% change. We used to have 75% hydrogen. I'm going to guess it's now 74% hydrogen. We used to have 25% helium. I'm going to guess it's now 26% helium. I'm guessing the amount of helium has increased and the amount of hydrogen has decreased, each by roughly 1%. Well, I've done a little bit of searching on the internet, and it's not easy to find that answer. Am I close? Over to you, Roy. KQIW.
Yes, Dick, you and Paul are close. Hank is not as close, but close. And I guess if you look hard enough, you'll find the answer. But if anyone else has any thoughts of it, keep in mind, of course, that you have to also factor in all the non-helium and hydrogen atoms out there. I mean, we're all made of all kinds of fun stuff: carbon and oxygen, sulfur, sodium, potassium, calcium, phosphorus, and such. So you have to kind of consider, you know, what percentage of those are in the universe as well.
Yes, there's a lot of those elements around from our point of view. We're sitting on a third generation solar system. In other words, our sun is a third generation sun after it's gone through a number of cycles of conversion. But although we think there's a lot of other elements around, it appears that a hell of a lot of the original mass of the universe has not undergone nuclear fusion yet. There's a hell of a lot of gas floating around that's not part of stars, and the gas in the stars, the vast majority of stars have not run down and done all of their fusion they're going to do. So, from one point of view, there's a hell of a lot of the original hydrogen of the primordial universe that has not yet been operated on. That's a possible explanation. Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
Yes, indeed, Dick. That's the moral of this particular story. As I mentioned before, 99% of all the photons in the universe are within the microwave cosmic background. The Big Bang is still the loudest bang that there ever was. And the same goes with all the other things. For all intents and purposes, the amount of mass of hydrogen is still 75%. The amount of mass of helium in the universe is still 25%. Unfortunately, it's a rounding error. All the other heavier elements exist, but in such small percentage that they all equal less than a percent. So, for all intents and purposes, things haven't changed much. And even though we exist because there are other elements, the universe generally is sort of blind to it. It's mostly hydrogen and helium. And again, with 25% helium in the universe, it's a shame that we're having a helium shortage down here on Earth.
That's just in our local backyard. Now, from time to time, we've heard about the universe running down, flaming out, going dark, getting cold, using up all of its energy. If less than 1% of the original raw ingredients of the universe had gone through some kind of nuclear conversion, and the other 99 and a fraction percent are still there ready to be reacted upon, one point of view, if you want to be optimistic, is that we're a long way from running down the whole universe. From that point of view, from a mass point of view and mass content, however, because of the expansion and the local density...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
The local density is becoming lower and lower. From that point of view, we're being spread so thin. If there is not a multi-universe, if there's a multi-universe, we're being spread out to some far direction, and some local universe is being spread out in our direction. So which one of those is going to dominate? But so if you want to be optimistic, you could say we're a long way from running down. We've only used up 1% of the available raw materials. Over to you, Roy, K2IW.
Well, Dick, I'm happy to tell people, reassure them, that according to the best theories presently available, the universe will keep on ticking for at least a trillion years. It's got a good amount of time. But eventually, as you mentioned, the scaling factor of solar systems and galaxies spreading out through larger and larger area in space-time, things will get colder and colder. The average kinetic energy will go lower and lower. And what the physicists have coined heat death of the universe, will occur trillions of years in the future when it just runs out of steam. You know, and who knows? I mean, if there is a multiverse, if there are collisions of higher dimensional universes that bang into each other that induce Big Bang, we might get banged again. But unfortunately, the way this works, it kind of locks you out of the previous time interval. It seems to be non-contiguous in a temporal way. But we have at least a trillion years. So the problem, though, is this planet doesn't have a trillion years. The sun will envelope the Earth in, you know, billions of years from now, but long before the trillion years of the heat death.
Soon after the Big Bang, the plasma that hadn't yet broken itself down into individual protons, neutrons, molecules, suns, planets, and whatever, the original plasma, everyone believes, was at some ridiculously high temperature, a zillion degrees in Kelvin, and it's been cooling off for 13.7, 13.8 billion years. We're now down to 2.73 degrees. If you get far away from a sun and a local planet, which if you have enough space travel capability, is easy. You can go out there, you can easily, there's a hell of a lot more places you can go where you're far away from a sun and planets. And if now you look in all directions and you make a temperature measurement, you'll see 2.73 degrees Kelvin. The black body temperature in all directions. Let me drop. So, we started off at a zillion degrees, we're down to 2.73. If a few more billion years from now, we're down to 2.0 instead of 2.73, I don't think you and I would feel very much of a difference. Our cosmic microwave background would be a slightly dimmer signal on the oscilloscope display or on the chart that you're plotting. What temperature you and I feel is primarily a function of how hot is our local sun and how close is our planet to that local sun. That's what really determines our temperature. The fact that the background sky is 2.73 or 2.0, we almost don't care. So the rundown in temperature for the first few billion years from now, I don't think is worth worrying about. We've still got some time. The fact that our sun is going to expand and envelop...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Vicky timed out there towards the end.
Yeah, I'm listening to the wrong frequency. The sun is going to get larger in 5 billion years, and the envelope of the sun will envelop the Earth. By the way, envelope and envelop are spelled the same way. You just change the way you pronounce it depending on which function you want that you're trying to express. There's a couple other crazy words in the English language like that. Over to you, Roy. K2IW.
K2IW, that was a quick question. What's your question?
Honest, you guys, no one's going to know the answer to this question. What prevents the sun from burning out prematurely? How is the hydrogen fusion in the sun regulated rather than going off all at once? I don't know if anyone wants to know the answer to that question.
That's called the light thrust effect. In other words, as a reaction takes place in the center of the sun, that reaction creates an outward pressure that pushes the raw ingredients out and limits the rate at which the ingredients can come in and contribute to that nuclear fusion. So the Leidenfrost effect is a self-limiting process. So the sun, if it wanted to, does not have the ability to burn up all of its hydrogen at once. The hydrogen is coming into the center to the reaction at a given rate controlled by that outward pressure. If more came in, the temperature would rise, the outward pressure would increase, and therefore less would come in. So it's a self-limiting process. Ain't that convenient? K2RIW, go ahead, Roy.
Yes, Dick, you're right. And, well, but it isn't inherent to all stars. Our star happens to have enough mass to produce a fusion reaction, but not enough mass to go beyond that limitation. Also, fortunately for us, the fusion of hydrogen to helium is a two-step phenomena, and one of them has an incredibly long time-limiting half-life reaction. So if fusion was a little bit easier for atoms to do, it would all go put in a fraction of a second, and there'd be none of us around to tell the story.
You can look at that, the whole situation now, in two different ways. From one point of view, if you're a spiritual person, you can say it's a beautiful design. From another point of view, you can say it had to be that way, otherwise we wouldn't be here and we wouldn't have a chance to be considering all this. So do we take the spiritual interpretation or the secular interpretation? The choice is yours. Over to you, Roy.
It's my surmise that planets that are unlucky enough to orbit near, say, Betelgeuse aren't having this philosophical conversation, because Betelgeuse is irradiating any planet within its solar system beyond belief. So, yeah, I tend to think of it in terms of the reason why it worked out so nicely is because it worked out so nicely. We're here to ask, why did it work out so nicely? Because there's a lot of places out there where it didn't work out so nicely, judging by what's in our own self-interest. A lot of supernovas out there, a lot of red giants out there, a lot of brown dwarfs out there. Our sun is not incredibly special, but it's a select small number of stars out in the universe.
But to back up on what you told us before, Roy, you're actually studying it and doing a little bit more internet research. Common sense would have led you to believe that the Big Bang was 13.8 billion years ago, and it would be very easy to say, hey, we've used up 80% of the raw ingredients by now. It looks like we've used up less than 1% of the raw ingredients. We've got some time left. We got some time left to convert. Over to you, Roy.
Yes, indeed. There's trillions of years out there. Just have to figure how to last that long. Rich?
Thanks.
Rich, you had a question or a comment?
Yeah, my question is, you used up in a big rip where, you know, basically every mansion at the end.
It depends what you kind of mean as the Great Rip. I mean, they've been using that term. The thing is, individual atoms are not spreading out. That's something that annoys people, because they talk about the expansion of the universe, and they sort of want to scale everything up over time, and it doesn't quite work that way. Over space, large objects that have less gravitational attraction to each other are spreading out as the volume of space-time increases. But for small objects close to each other, there's still gravitational forces acting upon them, holding them together. So I don't think it's quite going to be a tier where, you know, there's one atom every parsec or something. There'll probably be a little clump of very low energy, almost zero kinetic energy particles in bits and pieces. I think the universe will die, if you will, with a whimper, not quite with a bang.
In that case, entropy would be the final quiet death.
Well, there's a way of conceiving of heat death as being the state of infinite entropy. So six of one, half a dozen of the other. That seems to be the way that things are headed.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Come, Hank. Anyone else want to chit-chat about this? I'm in a chemical mood, so if you have any questions, great. If not, I have another little chemical puzzle to offer the audience.
Sure, why not? Well, one, my wife came home today and told me there was a worldwide shortage on helium, because she was looking to buy party balloons for her son's birthday. I also read that we want to try to synthesize helium. I'm wondering if you had any words on that. EC2, Janus, KC2, SSHO.
Well, John, if you're so inclined, you can synthesize a helium. You could also synthesize gold. It would be a lot of, it would cost you a lot per atom, and there's limited hardware to be able to do that. But theoretically, you can throw neutrons at things and turn them into transmute elements. It's not quite the same as the great alchemists wanted, where you just put a stone next to a bar of lead and it turns to gold. That's unfortunately the only way that we're going to get helium locally is by collecting radioactive material that undergoes alpha decay. Otherwise, there's no simple way of doing this. Okay, here's another chemical question, just because I like chemistry. The human body. People are much more interested in the human body than almost anything else. So, the next question is, how many different elements do you think it takes to basically come up with 99% of the mass of every human body? So in other words, it's not like we're all made out of 100%, carbon or anything. So there are more than 100 elements in the periodic table. How many of those elements do you think are required to account for 99% of your mass?
Next time.
Yes, Rich.
Given the fact that most of my responses to your questions are wild guesses, I will put in the number 5.
A very, very, very good guess, Rich. Does anyone else have any idea of how many different elements are required to pretty much explain 99% of your mass?
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
I have no idea, but I'm going to say 6. If I swallowed a penny, I could add copper to the list. Would that include something that you eat? I mean, that's part of you temporarily, anyway.
Not really, Paul, because then it could be almost anything. We're kind of averaging out the average digestive system. Most people, their GI tract is full of organic material that they absorb nutrition from. Most people, I don't think, go around swallowing pennies.
Okay, I tried to cheat. So, I don't know. If 5 was chosen already, I'll stick with 6. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. Anyone else with any suggestions? I'm kind of very pleased to hear that, people... I would think that the average person that you ask this to would grab on to a bigger number than 5 or 6. So I'm very pleased we have a very smart group of people here, so they know that it's surprisingly low. Anyone else with any suggestions?
Most of us are water.
We're good 70-80% water. They had a great line on Star Trek The Next Generation. There were these silicon creatures that called us ugly bags of mostly salt. They said ugly bags of water is what they, yeah. So, yeah, we're mostly water.
Comment to first question.
Okay, if it's a comment about this subject, feel free, Wes.
The previous question.
Okay, what's the comment or question about the previous thing?
One question somebody may ask is, how do you remove electrons from helium atoms to create alpha particles? And you said about alpha particles and helium. So what is the difference between alpha particles and helium?
Alpha particles are ionized helium. All you need is an electrical charge, and you could push electrons off of a helium atom, and they give a pretty light, like neon does as well. That's the only real difference. Usually they're traveling at almost relativistic velocities, so you have to take momentum as a quality of the average alpha particles as well. But there's not that much difference between a non-ionized and an ionized atom, except they're missing their electrons, and that's not a difficult thing for human beings to pull apart.
Well, I do agree. Alpha particles doesn't react chemically to form any ionic bonds. It steals the electron from Coulombic force, and the victim is... maybe it's a different way. The alpha particles are the same things as helium ions with 2+ charge. But the question is, again, how do you make it stable? Interesting.
Well, they're inherently not stable. They're electronically unbalanced. So as soon as you put them anywhere in an environment that they can capture other electrons in the area, they will. So, I mean, that's why, alpha particles are very short-lived, as you know from playing around with them.
So in other words, those two extra electrons needed to fill its orbit as orbital could be taken with from anything?
Basically, all electrons are equal. There's no, they're all identical. You could not tell one electron from another other than the energy levels that they possess at the time you're looking at them. But as far as a fundamental particle, they're all actually identical. There were some weird theories at one point that there's only one electron in the universe. It goes forward in time, then it reverses and becomes a positron, goes back to the beginning of time, then bounces back and forward in time, and it's the same electron all over the place. But I think those physicists were smoking something.
Electrical current in copper conductor is flowing electrons, has moving electrons. Could that be the source of those two electrons?
It could be. It could be the source of any electrons, even stable material. If you put them next to an ionized material, if their electropositivity is stronger, it'll rip the electron out of it. It's the reason why different metals plate other metals and not the other way around. There are certain levels of electron energy that the valence shells have, and if you get something with a weaker valence shell energy than your ion, it'll just rip that electron off of the neutral atom and take it for its own. But it could be in a wire, could be in a battery, could be in a rock.
Is there any difference between alpha particles striking copper with no current on it and copper with current on it? Interesting.
Well, it depends. For all intents and purposes, probably no. But if you go into the theories of what's going on, of eddy currents, of lens effects, and all these kind of, the way that Hall effects work, is that a current going through a wire produces an electric current and a magnetic field, and that's going to interact with an ion. So in some ways, it probably will interact. Will it be significant? Probably not.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome, Wes. Let me drop for a sec, and then we'll continue on with this little puzzle. Okay, you guys were very bright. There are basically six elements that make up 99% of the human body. You know, there's calcium, there's phosphorus, there's hydrogen, there's nitrogen, there's carbon, there's oxygen. Just six little elements make up 99% of you. So as a little side puzzler is if any of you would like to guess by mass which elements you have the most of and approximately what percentage of your entire body is one single element.
Yes, sir.
Rich.
Hydrogen, 60%.
Okay, one vote for hydrogen. Now, this is by weight, not by number. So, keep that in mind. Anyone else with any kind of educated guess?
I don't know, 60, maybe.
Which element is 60, do you think? John, I just said 60, but I wasn't quite sure what element was 60.
82FIU.
It's got to be calcium.
Nope. Neodymium. Andy.
Is this some kind of a weird show? Because there's practically no neodymium in most human beings. So I wouldn't think that we're all made of a lot of neodymium. George, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, there was some double T in there, but I don't know if calcium was said, and I'll go with that.
Dr. Roy, number 60 is neodymium. I was responding to number 60 in periodic table.
Okay, but I think John was cut off. I think he gave me an element of the six in the human body and then suggested that makes up 60% by mass, and I just wanted to know from John what was the element that he said he thinks makes up 60% of our mass.
So this is mean that means understanding. I thought he was referring to number 60 in periodic table.
That wasn't my understanding. So keep in mind, we already kind of at the early part of this little conversation mentioned that we're mostly made out of water, so that's a bit of a clue.
And because water is H2O, those two H's are one unit each, the oxygen is 16, so I'm going to guess since we're mostly water, and since oxygen is a lot heavier than the hydrogen, I'm going to guess the majority of the weight of a human being is oxygen. Over to you, Roy.
He did say single element, so I think maybe that caused confusion if that's true. But my answer was calcium. You know, if it's water, that's not a single element. KC2SHO.
No, John, I realize, you know, semantics and such. Basically, there's very little free elemental atoms in our body. They're almost all combined to form molecules. So there's water molecules, H2O. Calcium is also in the bone matrix and all kinds of things. They're ions that are made from the ionic bonding of two atoms as well. Anyway, Dick was quite right, because we are made out of so much water, and because the mass of water is made out of so much of oxygen, over two-thirds of our entire body is basically oxygen. So it's kind of interesting to think of all that weight reduced to its to its simplest form, would just float away weightless on the buoyancy of our atmosphere. Well, that's our chemistry puzzlers for tonight. I hope some of you enjoyed them. I hope it gave you a little bit more interest to look these things up. I'm going to put some links up and some demonstrations of what's going on there, but otherwise, I hope you enjoyed it. I'll let it drop, and then I'll go on to the next story.
Roy, is there a way that we can list the percentage of those six elements? You're saying 99% of the human body is made up out of six elements. just said that 66% is oxygen. Can we know the percentages of the other five elements?
Yes, you may. Oxygen is approximately 65% by mass. Carbon is approximately 18.5% by mass. Hydrogen is 9.5% by mass. Nitrogen is 3.2% by mass. Calcium is 1.5% by mass. And phosphorus is 1% by mass.
Well done.
Okay, per CNN, NASA emphasized that the agency plans to have the first female astronaut set foot on the lunar surface on the Artemis crew. $1 billion of the request would go directly to the commercial lunar lander, CNN wrote, while $651 million would be allocated to the development of the Orion multipurpose crew vehicle and repeatedly delayed space launch system, NASA's in-house rocket program to replace the retired space shuttle. 50 years after Apollo, the Artemis program will carry the next man and first woman to the moon, NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine said during a press call. The request is subject to congressional approval and, as the Times noted, follows Vice President Mike Pence's March announcement / threat that the White House wants NASA to have astronauts back on the moon by 2024 instead of 2028, or face some kind of unspecified reorganization. The former date conveniently falls within a theoretical two-term period. Let me drop for a sec. Somewhere in the neighborhood of $22 million would also be set aside for the development of technologies crucial to expanding future U.S. lunar presence, Time wrote. NASA is also seeking $132 million for developing technologies like converting ice within craters at the moon's poles to water and $90 million for robotic exploration of the moon. Mr. Bridenstine said that even higher increases would be needed in future years and that NASA was still figuring out how much that would be. He described the current request as a down payment. That adds up to about $1.6 billion. But NASA would offset some $321 million by shaving its prior request for $824 million to fund a lunar orbiting space station named Gateway, another part of the Moon project. Now, Bridenstine has said that the project would be reduced to just two modules, one for power and habitation. Let me drop for a sec. $1.6 billion is not a hoard of treasure by federal government standards, but it does effectively reverse Trump's prior 2020 budget request of $21 billion for NASA, which would have been a year-over-year decrease of $500 million. NASA Administrator Jim Bridenstine had already described the $21 billion request as sufficient to meet the 2028 date. However, the lion's share of the funding would come from unallocated money in the Pell Grant Program, a financial aid program for low-income students, the Washington Post reported. And the White House says that the program has a surplus of $9 billion due to decreased enrollment, and no students would see reduced assistance as a result, though critics have asserted for years that taking away reserve funds would endanger its long-term viability and leave it struggling if there is a surge in demand. This poses the risk of jeopardizing Democratic support for this stepped-up effort, which was already far from guaranteed. There is likely to be ample suspicion that 2024 is not a realistic date and that Trump just wants to subsidize promises of another moon landing in his second term with government money. Let me drop for a sec. Some external estimates for the program have come in at $6 to $8 billion annually until 2024. Bridenstine has characterized that number as too high, but University of Colorado astrophysicist Jack O'Byrne told the Times his estimate was that NASA actually needs $25 billion annually to launch in 2024. They also noted that New York Representative Jose Serrano, who heads the House Budget Subcommittee in charge of NASA funding and is in the his last term, has suggested in the past that the 2028 target is perfectly acceptable and that Trump is only accelerating the timeline so he can talk the project up before the 2020 election. The White House has also been rumored to be considering pushing for a continuing resolution to maintain 2019 levels of federal funding through fiscal year 2020. Then again, request a short-term extension to maintain those spending limits through the November election. Administration officials believe that this would position them to push for the gigantic cuts in the first year of Trump's second term. But it could also spell doom for a moon landing in 2024. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
There was somebody, I'm trying to remember who it was, that was in the news, I guess a congressman or maybe a congresswoman, that said that they need, they didn't want to take the money from the Pell Grants, because, you know, that's for education.